Hello and welcome back to the Mobile Chicanes for another week. It's Naveen Razik here alongside me. It's Joshua Carawalden. We're going to be going through all the big news. We're leading up to Indy and the Monaco Grand Prix in a couple of weeks' time, as well as plenty of other action from around the world of motorsport. We will go first, though, to the Spanish Grand Prix, probably the most interesting Spanish Grand Prix we've actually had for quite a while. It was won by Lewis Hamilton in a thrilling strategic battle with Sebastian Vettel. And we really got to see these two teams go right at it and pushing right to the limit to try and eke out some sort of advantage. It was sort of really classic old-style Formula One.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, just the race as a whole, you know, not just for Vettel and Hamilton, but for basically every driver in the field, it was a really gritty, you know, get right stuck into it and just, you know, go for it type of race. You know, it was one of those races that, you know, really does favour you know, some of the more traditional types of drivers where they just get stuck in. And it was the case as, yeah, it was a really long, hard-fought battle, basically all race long between Vettel and Hamilton, both trading blows, you know, and the two strategic parts of both Mercedes and Ferrari really going at each other. So it was a fantastic race as a whole. And there were unfortunately, you know, the Bottas and Raikkonen taken out of the equation at turn one on lap one. So that, you know, who knows, they could have thrown up you know, just a wildcard presence. But realistically, you know, even from the start, you know, you could just see that the pace was all Vettel and Hamilton. And yeah, just the race as a whole, you know, hopefully it's a sign of things to come. And if it is, then we're in for a fantastic season. As Vettel, I believe he's got an 8-point lead in the championship stage right now, ahead of Lewis Hamilton. So, yeah, Monaco coming up in a couple of weeks, as Naveen said. And yeah, Ferrari have had a very long drought at Monaco. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's all to play for. And yeah, it's we're now into the European season, so yeah, there are going to be upgrades coming left, right, front and centre, and yeah, it's going to be a massive head-to-head fight.
So it was pretty much action from the get-go, including on that one where we saw lots of chaos going on. We saw, it was a chain reaction, effectively. Valtteri Bottas just tagged the back of Kimi Raikkonen, who then tagged Max Verstappen, putting both of them effectively out of the race. And of course, Bottas didn't last much longer in the end. He had to retire a bit later on. It's sort of difficult to assert and blame for that one. I think that was a proper racing incident. And that was the good thing about this weekend in terms from the stewards. We didn't get any stupid penalties. Mostly everything was pretty considered. But yeah, we saw some fantastic racing, in particular this battle between Carlos Sainz and Kevin Magnussen in the pit lane, which was quite tense, as well as the battle for the front, which is something we haven't usually seen. Such as Sebastian Vettel's pass on the grass, the best way to pass, of course, on Lewis Hamilton, and Hamilton doing in one better with a superb DRS overtake. I think the changes to DRS really worked well, because usually the problem with Spain is that you can't pass when you've got so much air on the cars and the DRS zones aren't long enough to enable anything. So I think the changes they made were really good, and I think it probably is probably the reason why you've had one of the best Spanish Grand Prix in ages.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I could certainly agree with that. You know, just the whole field, you know, really, you know, utilizing the DRS, particularly on the front straight, very, very well. And, yeah, like, you know, it's worked an absolute treat. And there are a couple more Grand Prix circuits throughout the rest of the season that will have that opportunity for longer DRS straights. Unfortunately, Monaco isn't one of those DRS straights, as it's basically maxed out already. Also, as well, you know, a really big shout out to Pascal Wehrlein, who got 8th place for Sauber and got 4 valuable points. Would have been 7th if it wasn't for the pit lane penalty he received. And not only is it great for Sauber to get into points, but if it was the older point system where points were awarded to the top 8, Sauber still would have got points. So it's an even bigger achievement, given that it is at Barcelona, than what he did with Manor at Austria last year.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, particularly in a year-old Ferrari engine, and it now puts Sauber Honda ahead of McLaren Honda in the standings. The Honda now dead last, not what they would have wanted. Of course, one of the interesting things about this race is just the massive gap between first and the second, who were in a tight race, to third all the way back. There was a lot of talk about Daniel Ricciardo and Red Bull and how they would go, particularly because there was a lot of, well, probably false hype saying that, oh, this is a completely different car. This should really be called the RB14, not the RB13. But they just didn't bring any sort of fight to it. They were well off in qualifying. And you can just see the difference from Daniel Ricciardo, who was the only other car to finish on the lead lap. It just shows how far ahead Mercedes and Ferrari are, I guess. And it's disappointing that Red Bull aren't able to put it together like they did last year, because they really had a strong car last year, and we were hoping they would do the same and possibly open this up to a three-way fight, the likes of which we haven't seen since 2010.
Yeah, for sure. And it certainly is disappointing. And realistically, Red Bull's best chance of a Grand Prix win this year is at the Monaco Grand Prix, just because, and possibly at the Hungaroring. You know, just because, you know, that's just something that suited their car over the past few years. And yes, you know, it didn't, the chassis upgrade didn't give the expected returns as what it did at Spain last weekend. However, you know, because Monaco is Monaco, it's a driver's circuit, but then again, but at the same time, you know, low speed downforce and overall chassis performance is critical there. Then it keeps Red Bull sort of, you know, there, you know, close and, you know, ready to capitalize if both Mercedes and Ferrari make a mistake. So, yeah, it's disappointing. I really do think it just capitalizes that that Ricciardo and Verstappen will just finish fifth and sixth for the rest of this year, unless there are issues to the top four. It's unfortunate given the talent of both the drivers and I think, you know, everyone just knows, and it's been said quite a lot over the past few months, that a title fight between Ricciardo and Verstappen would be one for the ages. So it's disappointing, and realistically, you know, it'd be fantastic if both Ricciardo and Verstappen win there. But given that we are now five races done in a 20-race season, I think, you know, I said this last week, you know, they're just basically going for Grand Prix victories, and I am slightly concerned that this is the start of new regulations in F1, and next year's car will be an evolution on this year. So it is pretty disappointing to see, you know, just this basically just poor car from Red Bull at a very critical time.
And then Red Bull themselves, if you look at the team, it's not an interesting driver dynamic at the moment, in that we've only actually had one race where both cars have finished, and in that race it was Max Verstappen who was in front. I mean, other than that, looking on the results, it's fairly even Stevens Ricciardo just ahead, simply because he's had a slightly more consistent run than Max Verstappen in terms of points. But it's very interesting, and it's very close, and in particular, we might possibly see this is possibly the last decent season that Ricciardo will necessarily have, because we know Verstappen is certainly a very good talent, but it's just taken him a couple of years to mature. But I think he might now be starting to hit his prime, just when Ricciardo is starting to fade a little bit. And this could, of course, be very interesting, particularly next year if the Red Bull do put together a decent car, the way this dynamic will go. We sort of don't really know who is the number one and the number two driver, Joe.
Yeah, and let's not forget, Daniel Ricciardo is 27 at the moment. I think he's turning 28 later this year. So, you know, he's certainly not old by any means, but the window is closing, and he did say that at Monaco last year after the tyre drama at the pit stop. So, yeah, time's ticking for Ricciardo, and, you know, we all know Verstappen, you know, is, you know, one of the future, you know, I call him, you know, one of the future greats. You know, he's gonna really challenge for a championship at some point in his career. Like, you know, if Red Bull just keep giving him, you know, terrible cars, and, you know, it's pretty easy to see Verstappen go elsewhere, as, you know, everyone in the paddock knows that he's a future star, and, well, you could almost call him a current star now. Everyone rates Ricciardo, but, you know, just the window can only be open for so long, and you can only be in the Red Bull top team for so long until the next generation comes in and takes his seat. So, yeah, interesting times ahead for Ricciardo, and yeah, I really do think that if it continues, and if one thing leads to another, then he could actually start panicking. By the time we reach, say, Malaysia or Japan.
It's interesting, particularly if he decides to actually stay at that team in the future, particularly given that their championship chances have taken a little bit of a hit recently. Probably the general underrated performers so far this season would have to be Force India, who the only team to finish every race in the top 10, or one of the few teams who've had drivers finish every single race. I mean, the attrition has generally been rather spread out across the rest of the field. And so far, they are sitting where they were last year, fourth in the Constructors' Championship, which is not something we were expecting this year. We thought they would possibly stick behind Williams or Toro Rosso, but no, they've been able to keep it going, even though they don't have the funds. I mean, their owner is currently in the courts in India and probably won't own that team for much longer. And there was some rumours going around. Bernie Ecclestone was saying he might possibly try and bring back the Brabham name and buy out the team just to stay in Formula One. But it is certainly a very interesting state of affairs for Force India, and in particular just where they are in the terms of the midfield. They're sort of leading that sort of the second class, effectively, of Formula One, and that's something which you weren't expecting, and it's quite exciting, particularly given how the solid performance they put on the weekend, fourth and fifth.
Yeah, for sure. And, Force India right now, they're the best team on the grid that does the best with what they've got. They really do maximise, their car, their engine, and just their general facilities over a weekend. And, yeah, they've done fantastic so far this season. And, it's really surprised me. Perez, we sort of expected this from him, to just be, a really solid driver. And the real good story of the year so far has been Esteban Ocon, his teammate. I personally did rate Ocon very highly, and I thought that this would be a really good year for him, following on from his fantastic performance in preseason testing. And yeah, he's shown his worth, and he's definitely cemented his future in F1. As let's not forget, I don't think he's actually competed in 10 Grand Prix yet. I think he's still. I think last weekend was his 8th or 9th Grand Prix, because he did come in.
He might have done about. I think he's probably done about 12 or 13.
Yeah. So, but then again, still very, very young and very inexperienced. And for him to, be as good as what he has been, throughout this season, in a team that's, not as well funded, and not as, I would say, not as, not having the same potential as the other teams around him, he's done a fantastic job. And I can't really speak highly enough of him. As Ocon, he is matching Perez, and that's something I certainly didn't expect at the start of this season. Given that Perez, he's at a stage of his career where he's being talked about as Kimi Raikkonen's replacement, and for Ocon to come in 12 or 13 Grand Prix into his F1 career and to start matching him, it just speaks about how much talent Esteban Ocon has.
Yeah, he's certainly going to be one to watch, sort of one of the underrated performers, a bit like Pascal Wehrlein was a couple of years ago. Now, we do have to talk about McLaren Honda, not necessarily for the reasons that we would think. Like, Fernando Alonso put in a very good effort over the weekend to get that car into the points, but of course, he slid back further in the race. We still don't know exactly where they are in terms of pace, whether they're still dead last, or whether they made some improvements with Mercedes. But I do want to talk about Stoffel Vandoorne, who had a very disappointing weekend, and he's had a very disappointing run. He's currently sitting right at the bottom of the championship, behind even Antonio Giovinazzi. He hasn't finished higher than 13th so far, and whilst part of that is probably due to the fact he's got some terrible machinery, considering the gap between him and Alonso over the weekend, I mean, he was over a second off Alonso, over a second and a half off Alonso, which is extraordinary. It's not necessarily been the start we wanted to see for Stoffel Vandoorne, who was very highly rated by a lot of people as the next challenger, and he's just really sort of struggled so far this season. Now, Josh, do you think he has long to turn it around?
I can certainly see that he's has the ability to turn it around. Right now, we don't really actually know what's happening with McLaren Honda on the actual inside of the team itself. Like, we don't really know if they're giving Alonso all the best parts or all the most reliable parts, and are just having Vandoorne there just to fill the grid. So we don't know that yet. But let's not forget his debut at Bahrain last year. Like, I mean, I don't really think that's an actual fluke. When you factor in, how dominant he was when he won the GP2 title a couple of years ago. So he's got the talent. It's just that, there's just something missing. It's not right. It could just be, outside influence, the sponsors wanting to see their man Alonso do so much better than this relatively actually unknown rookie sensation. So it could be that, there would be quite a few factors in this, but I certainly wouldn't write off Vandoorne as just a pretender in terms of what he could potentially become.
I think the main thing that sort of put doubts in people's minds was, of course, the incident he had with Felipe Massa, which arguably helped Lewis Hamilton get back in front because it gave us a virtual safety car, which is a really odd one. He said he didn't see him, even though Massa was clearly well up inside. Whether it was just a lack of just awareness or the fact that he probably isn't used to racing in effectively racing for position, I guess, considering so far he's back. It's still a difficult one, and we'll see how he goes over the next few weeks.
Yeah, for sure. And realistically, Monaco this weekend, it could be pretty telling, or it could just be, just another weekend where the car just, basically puts, makes, just grades, where Vandoorne is, really is compared to everyone else in the current generation of car. It could just mask it. So it really depends, but I certainly wouldn't unfortunately he does have a grid penalty, which means he probably will be starting the Monaco Grand Prix from 20th. So you could say that his Monaco Grand Prix debut has been ruined before it even began. It will really all come down to qualifying, and I don't think I would expect him to get out of Q1 and into Q2, but if he's, up there in, say, 17th in qualifying, then that's an okay job. It really just shows, how terrible this year's McLaren Honda is.
Yeah, it's not looking great for them, particularly given how well their Indy 500 tilt seems to be going. Now, of course, this week was the first European race of the season and the first European race under Liberty's control. And we saw a whole raft of changes. They had this new fan zone, which includes things like says racing simulators, pit stop challenges, some live performances, and even a 200-meter zip line, which sounds exciting even more so, I guess, if it went over the track. I mean, that would be the ultimate F1 experience. I don't think it did, unfortunately. They also had a proper TV channel going. So instead of showing the world feed, they were showing interviews and stuff like that, a bit like very much like what happens, I guess, in some of these other individually promoted races outside, like, of course, the Australian Grand Prix, which has been well known for having lots of fan engagement and the interviews and the fact that we've got a proper team working on the feed and stuff like that. And, of course, that was all capped off by the fantastic moment where we saw this young French Kimi Raikkonen fan who was in tears after he was taken out of the first corner. Got given the opportunity to meet him. This was not necessarily Liberty's doing, but it was Ferrari's doing. But it certainly shows there's been a massive change in approach in fan engagement. I mean, even having the drivers on the grid after qualifying, it was incredibly rushed in the last minute. But it was extraordinary. And I mean, probably the biggest sign would have to be the presence of T-shirt launchers, T-shirt guns at the race, which is probably the most American thing. It just shows it's how different Formula One has become just simply by a different approach taken by the management.
Yeah, for sure. And, Liberty Media, I think they'd be, really happy with, just with how, last weekend went. Just the reception was overwhelmingly, positive, and, You can almost call them Liberty Media fanboys, you know, in every YouTube comments section on the F1 channel. You know, it's normally almost always in the top five comments on YouTube. And it's an amazing to see. And also as well, you know, from it to come to Ferrari, who are, you know, traditionally have been, you know, the most reserved, secretive team, and basically the most Bernie Eccleston type team, for them to come out and do that, you know, it actually, you know, really surprised me. Like, you know, when I woke up and checked my phone and, you know, saw that, oh yeah, you know, young F1 fan, you know, meets Kimi Raikkonen, has ultimate F1 fan experience, it's like, wait, what is this? And it was just fantastic to see. And yeah, and I you can almost be assured that that fan, that young kid, will become basically a full-time F1 fan for the next 20, 30 years. And it's just fantastic to see. And also encourage, you know, other fans, you know, not necessarily for the Monaco Grand Prix, because it is, you know, so expensive and so grand, and it can really hold its own on the world stage without F1. But, you know, certainly for tracks like, you know, Silverstone in particular, Canada, and, you know, all the rest, you know, all the really big races, you know, with big crowd attendance and not so big off-track action that has been offered under the Bernie Eccleston era, you know, it will really encourage, you know, those fans to come out. So, yeah, it's just fantastic all round, and yeah, it's hard to see how it could have gone any better for Liberty Media.
So all in all, a fairly satisfactory weekend of Formula One action, I'd have to say. Which is not something you say often about Formula One, but it's nice when we have it. Let's move on now to supercars. Of course, the action kicks off this weekend at Winton, the Winton Super Sprint. But before then, we've had some big, big news coming out of HSV/Walkinshaw Racing. The news that their team manager, Adrian Burgess, has been sacked. He's left the team with immediate effect. The man, of course, brought DJR back to the front of the grid at the end of the 2010, helped Triple Eight maintain their strong run of form during 2011 to 2013, and of course has worked with Jordan and the like and had plenty of experience overseas in the UK. Has now left HSV Racing after he joined the team in 2014. It's certainly a big move. It surprised everyone, but there was a lot of criticism about this, about HSV's performance at Perth. James Courtney described the team's performance as embarrassing, but it is certainly a big move. I mean, it shocked a lot of people in the paddock. Mark Larkham was really surprised that Ryan Rockenshaw would really go to these efforts. And I think Courtney was a bit surprised as well, which has really left HSV back at square one, or 2014 as it was, because it's shown the last 3 years have effectively been wasted in a way. I mean, things have only really gotten worse, Josh.
Yeah, you know, I think we spoke about this last week, you know, just the dire straits that that Walkinshaw are in. And, yeah, something needed to change, for sure, but I don't think this is the right way to approach it, because, you know, I do rate Adrian Burgess. Let's not forget, he was part of the team in 2010 at Dick Johnson Racing that basically took on and won the 888 Juggernaut back in 2010. So, you know, there's definitely talent there. And, you know, like F1 teams, you know, certainly don't employ, you know, those that, you know, just don't do their job right in terms of team management. And, yeah, it just speaks highly about Adrian Burgess. And then once he was at 888, you know, he did, you know, put in quite a few good performances. And, you know, at the time when he was at 888, you know, he was almost seen as, you know, the man who would basically relieve Roland Dane of his duties so he can relax on his yacht on race weekends. You know, and Roland Dane certainly doesn't, again, you know, he certainly doesn't, you know, employ people, you know, in such high positions that are incompetent at their jobs. So I do think this isn't the right call, from Ryan Walkinshaw. And, it's really dire at the moment. Like, you've got Scott Pye, who, you know, let's not forget, you know, he is a pretty good driver, and he almost won the development series a couple of years ago in what was, you know, what is consistently regarded as one of the strongest Dunlop Series grid, with him having to go up against Nick Percat, Chaz Mostert, and series champion Scott McLaughlin. So yeah, Pye's got talent for sure, and you know he just hasn't been able to capitalize. And it's been even more frustrating when you factor in how Garth Tander's gone to Gary Rogers Motorsport, who have, you know, built two very rushed cars and have had much less preparation time for the actual season itself and the R&D over the season as a whole. And, you know, he's doing much better than both James and Scott Pye. And it's just really, really frustrating, as James Moffat is also ahead of both James Courtney and Scott Pye in the championship standing. So something has to change at Walkinshaw. This wasn't the right call. I would have certainly seen Adrian Burgess as, you know, the leader of the Walkinshaw Racing rebuild, as, you know, this was a really big year for them, you know, to, you know, basically, as this is their first year, I think basically since early 1990, you know, 1989, where they have basically had to go it alone, without the support of Holden. So yeah, and they've, you know, made an absolute mess of it, as, you know, Garth Tander, you know, got ninth in the standings last year for HRT. James Courtney got 11th, and currently, as it stands, in 2017, James Courtney is in 15th, four places down, and Scott Pye is in a very low 18th place. So yeah, it just speaks volumes about, you know, where Mobil 1 HSV Racing is, and just how, you know, deep of a hole they're in. And it's going to take it's now become much more difficult for them to dig themselves out of hole, because, you know, yes, they've got an acting director of Matthew Nilsson, who hasn't got the same experience and pedigree as Burgess, but he's got a little bit of experience and know-how about how to run a race team, and it's going to be very difficult to convince anyone, really, you know, around the caliber of Adrian Burgess to come to Walkinshaw Racing and to help a team that's, you know, really struggling and really needs a culture change very, very soon.
Yeah, and that seems to be what it is, just the culture. I mean, I think you could see there were systematic problems long on the fact that relations broke down with Garth Tander as early, pretty much right after his Sandown 500 win, which was the crowning glory of last season. I mean, they've had some good results in that they have won the Pertec Enduro Cup in 2015. It's a mostly useless trophy, but it is still a piece of silverware nonetheless. But the loss of Garth Tander, I guess, was probably a big thing which sort of kicked off, and you could tell he really wasn't happy. I guess it's probably a bit like the McLaren situation. I guess it's just they've been lucky enough, even though they've lost a lot of their major backer, they still have enough sponsors. So there's still a people who are hoping that the brand does work, and people who've got skin in the game. So exactly why this slide has happened is still a mystery, I guess. But it does seem like there needs to be a bit of a shift, and whether exactly Burgess leaving will change that, we don't know. We don't know how he was working the team and the like, but yeah, it's going to be a difficult long road back, and you'd have to say, you can almost certainly say this season is now a rebuilding season. You'll be very optimistic to see them on the top step of the podium anytime soon. I mean, only they've had one this year, which is a dire start even by their standards. So yeah, it's a difficult one, and it's going to be interesting to see how that runs, also how it will affect their GT program as well, and the flow on with that and the like. Of course, we head off to Winton later this week. Of course, it's an extensive testing track. It's pretty much the Barcelona of the Supercars Championship. And of course, last year we had some very strong performances from Brad Jones Racing. We saw Tim Slade pretty much dominate that entire weekend. So it's still it's an interesting circuit, Winton. I mean, Dick Johnson described it as running a marathon around your clothesline, but it is certainly going to be interesting to see how it plays out, and particularly if it manages to benefit some of the lesser-known teams, particularly BJR, who have had a sort of a disappointing start to the year. They sort of slipped behind Gary Rogers Motorsport, I guess, in terms of the second-class Holden team. So it'll be interesting to see how they go.
Yeah, it will be interesting. And, you know, it's a really big weekend for Nick Percat, who's had, you know, a really terrible season so far, you know, just not getting any performance whatsoever, and, you know, really just being outclassed consistently by his teammate Tim Slade. And yeah, this will be a really big weekend for Percat, as, you know, he did burst on the scene very, very early, you know, with that Bathurst 1000 win alongside Garth Tanner in 2011. And, you know, I still remember his performance on that day. And, you know, it was a very mature performance for such a young driver. And ever since then, he's just been, you know, very mediocre. As, yeah, it just hasn't worked for him at all. So, yeah, it is a big weekend for him. And I'm sure that Brad Jones will be looking forward to this weekend and has been for quite a while, basically ever since, you know, the results just weren't there at all last weekend at Barbagallo. I can be assured that, you know, he's really looking forward to Winton, as he always, or probably always does. It's also a very big weekend and what could be a very defining weekend for Chas Mostert, as traditionally the Victorian teams have been, you know, very, you know, they've always been pretty terrible at Winton, you know, just because, you know, that they just know too much of the Winton circuit, and they normally have a, you know, a very, almost, I'd almost call it an overused, you know, baseline setup for Winton, which is where, you know, the likes of Red Bull and DJR Team Penske and Techno, you know, whereas those will actually, you know, make their baseline setup around the conditions. So it's going to be a really big weekend for Chas Mostert, you know, as he's definitely in this championship fight, only 31 points behind. And if he can get, you know, a podium and a really good, you know, bag of points and get consistent top fives in all sessions, then he's definitely a championship contender. He is flying under the radar now, and he did say that back at Phillip Island when he did get that race win. As, yeah, you know, he has a lot of potential, and, you know, we did see, you know, back in 2015 that he almost, basically stole Mark Winterbottom's Lana-weighted championship victory if it wasn't for that crash at Bathurst. So, yeah, a really big weekend for Chas if he gets another podium and, you know, consistent top fives at Winton. Then there's no reason why he can't be a championship contender, you know, looking towards the rest of the season. You know, they're all likable circuits for Chas, and, you know, he has got his Enduro Cup campaign is looking pretty solid as well. So, yeah, it's going to be a really, really a big weekend for Chas Mostert as well as Nick Percat.
Breaking news at the moment, just in the last few minutes, we've had word that Craig Lowndes has signed a new two-year deal with 888 Racing. Of course, he's been with them pretty much for most of his career. And of course, he will remain there in the Team Vortex entry. He was in the final year of his current agreement, having signed a two-year extension back in 2015. He's 42 now, and it does mean that he will get a chance to pilot the new Gen 2 Holden Commodore, which is set to debut next year. A pretty stock standard logical choice, Josh, from what we've seen at the moment. And he's been up there, I guess. He had a disappointing start to the year. He's currently eighth in the standings. And Ascent has only got the one podium, which was at the Simmons Plains race, which was ultimately ruled as a non-classified finish. So it's going to be interesting to see how he goes next year, but it's probably the safest place he can go, because I don't think there are really any other teams that are looking that really offer him the options he can have at 888.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do remember Craig Lowndes saying earlier this year that he wouldn't re-sign with 888 if he didn't believe that he would have the ability in that Team Vortex entry to win more races and possibly contend for future championships. So that's encouraging on the Team Vortex side of the garage for him and his race mechanic Irish. So That's looking pretty good for him. So yeah, and he will be 44 by the end of his contract at the end of the 2019 season. So yeah, it would be pretty it's going to be interesting to see what lies beyond that. But right now, it's a positive sign. Positive signs. If Craig sees that Team Vortex can win future races, then there's no then there is cause for some relief, as they've been up and down, and realistically, his biggest problem, as it has always been, is just car setup. At Phillip Island, he was just nowhere with the car setup. He wasn't particularly happy, and I don't really think, he found the right balance with that constricted setup with the tyre camber. So that's why you just had such a poor performance at Phillip Island. And, just his general attitude, and he has spoken about this before, is just the she'll be right attitude. And that's really, becoming more and more, of a hampering when you consider how close the field is getting. So, and that's very unlike Jamie Whincup, who's got the attitude of near enough is just not good enough. So, that attitude, and he has said that in the past, it is a hindrance, and, it is something that does affect him, as, he does have the ability to just be given a setup and go, that's okay, we'll just, feel around with tyre pressures and camber, and, we should be all good for qualifying. So, obviously he sees the potential, and, it's good for him to just have a 2-year extension. And, it's going to be interesting to see how the future holds. Like, he's sort of been flying under the radar, and, there are only real cause for concern from his loyal fan group is that, during practice sessions and through some qualifying sessions, he has been, further down the order. So, but he always manages to pick it up during the race. So, 2-year deal, good for Craig Lowndes. But then again, the results that he will get over the next 2.5 years, is far from certain.
He's not really the kind of driver to have that sort of killer edge sort of attitude, who likes to close out and is super precise. He's more of a laid back kind of guy, which I guess is what really contrasted him to Jamie Whincup, who is very much trying to find that extra 10th. I mean, even he's probably, Shane Van Gisberg is probably a little bit more laid back, I would say, I think because of the amount of work, but he still puts in the hard yards. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. To be honest, though, I think he's very satisfied with where he is at the moment. He's got 2 supercars championships. Not many people, considering the amount of one-time champions we have on the grid, that's still a pretty good margin of achievement, you'd have to say. And, yeah, I think he's just satisfied and contented. Just wants, effectively, this is probably a superannuation supercars deal, you'd have to say. I mean, he's flogging MTAA Super a lot, so he's obviously got some money in there, and he wants to put a little bit more onto the bank. But yeah, in general, I think he's just driving for the enjoyment, I guess. And I guess when he stops enjoying it, he'll stop. Well, it's nice to see he's sticking around, and of course, supercars does need its fan favourites. I mean, we've seen the how difficult the road could be for NASCAR once they lose Dale Earnhardt Jr. I don't think supercars is quite yet prepared to say goodbye to Craig Lowndes, and I think it's a good thing. He'll be staying around the grid with his smile and everything. Now, before we stop talking supercars, we'll just have a quick look at the standings, which are, of course, very interesting at the moment. It's incredibly tight. I mean, we've got the top 5 drivers within 30 points, which in supercars terms, where you've got a decent, you've got 75 points, I think, for a sprint win, and 150 points for feature or something like that. It's certainly very close indeed, and it's certainly, and in particular, most of the guys in here are on pretty good form streaks as well, which is something you don't usually see. Shane Van Gisbergen, he had a great start to the year, sort of dipped off a little bit, but he's still been consistently finishing in the top 10, with the exception of his incident at Phillip Island. Fabian Coulthard, he's probably been the most consistent driver of all of them, which is why, of course, he's at the top, in terms of just putting in the performances and getting the wins and the podiums he needs. Jamie Whincup hasn't had a win yet, probably the longest we've seen Whincup without taking a win, but he's in third place. and just probably been the most consistent to another consistent drive from him. Scott McLaughlin really took his time to get things going, but with two wins, he is now in fourth position, and he's now really looking like he's going to get swing to a good bit of form. And of course, Chas Mostert, who took the win at Phillip Island, the breakthrough win, and also looks to be pretty solid as well. So it is really exciting, and it's going to be interesting to see where, continuing all these guys are sort of in similar places in terms of the form, ebb and flow and like. So it's certainly going to be interesting, and I guess Winton will sort of set the tone, I guess, now that we've got these five championship contenders sort of locked in. You'll sort of set the tone for the way we go through the rest of the season, particularly when we head off up north to Hidden Valley, which is, of course, a wild card, and then to the Queensland run before the Enduros.
Yeah, it really will be key to see Winton, you know, as I said, you know, does really favour the Queensland teams, and Hidden Valley, you know, it could go any way. Townsville, you know, has always been a pretty good circuit for Triple Eight and Queensland Raceway. Penske would actually have the edge there, you know, with possibly Pro Drive as well. Then hanging off to Sydney Motorsport Park, you know, that's sort of more of a Red Bull circuit than Sandown, you know, that could go either way. Bathurst, you know, it's Bathurst, you can't really pick form. Surface Paradise, interesting, you know, it's not been Wink Cup circuit, but it sort of is Van Gisbergen circuit, also as well, Scott McLaughlin has had good form around Surface Paradise. Fabian Coulthard's been solid. Obviously, he was involved with that crash with Garth Tander on the front straight. Pukekohe, you know, that'll be a strong circuit for McLaughlin and for Van Gisbergen, being two homeboys as well as Fabian Coulthard. Pro Drive has sort of struggled there in the past. And then the finale at Newcastle, which will be a complete unknown. So, there are strong circuits and weak circuits for all three teams coming up, and it's really going to be mostly be about, you know, just getting as much points as you can for the weak circuits to really capitalise yourself for a very good weekend at your strong circuits. So yeah, it's certainly very, very, very far from over, and either five of those top five right now could win it.
Yes, certainly looks to be another exciting supercars round that'll be kicking off this weekend at Winton. Moving to the United States and to the Verizon IndyCar Series, where finally, after three terrible races to start the season, Will Power finally gets his first win of the season, his 30th win in his career at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway road course race, the Indy Grand Prix. He led every session at the road course and pretty much led most of the race. A very dominant performance from him. He finally seems to have broken through that form gap that has plagued him pretty much all the way since Watkins Glen last year, which is just really good to see. And it's also our fifth different IndyCar winner out of five races, which shows that this season is just turning into a surprisingly competitive one, particularly when we thought that it was just going to be Penske domination. Josh, it certainly looks like it's certainly the best result that Will Power will have heading into this 500 season. And just in general, another strong finish from him.
Yeah, just the result that Will Power needed. Like we have said quite a few times that Will Power really needs to pull something out to just get back into the championship hunt. And now, you know, from his second place finish at Phoenix and his win Indianapolis road course, where he also got pole position and led the most laps, so just did everything he needed to do. You know, it's fantastic for him, and he's now sitting a comfortable 56 points behind Simon Pagenaud, who is typically weaker at Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We did see last year that he strung together the wins early in the season, went on a bit of a streak, and then just basically went nowhere after Indy. It's all to play for, and it's certainly really up in. Unfortunate that Dale Coyne Racing have basically hit the reality. The honeymoon period is over for Sebastian Bourdais and Ed Jones, with Bourdais getting 22nd and not finishing. Having to pull off pretty early in the piece that follows from his retirement from his lap one turn one crash because of Mikhail Lotion at Phoenix the other weekend. And Ed Jones has been just struggling for pace as well, finishing 19th last weekend and finishing in a respectable 11th place at Phoenix. So yeah, reality setting in for Dale Coyne Racing. Also, as well, we have to factor in Scott Dixon, who's only 10 points behind Simon Pagenaud, who is an IndyCar all-rounder in terms of street circuits, road courses, and also as well the ovals. So, yeah, Scott Dixon is certainly one to keep an eye on, who hasn't actually finished outside the top five all season, who's been really consistent. He just hasn't had that win yet. So Scott Dixon is in very good form. Joseph Newgarden, he's been a bit, iffy in the past few races. He finished 11th at Indianapolis last weekend and did get unlucky with the way the cautions came out at Phoenix. He finished 9th. Helio Castroneves, as always, is always there in the background. And also as well, another fantastic weekend for Juan Pablo Montoya and for Spencer Pigot, who have had pretty mediocre season so far. Montoya, his first race in IndyCar all season, gained a very good performance. I think he made it into the Firestone Fast 6 for qualifying and then finished in 10th place. So a very good comeback for Montoya to just get some really good points. Not that it really matters in his case, and get a solid top 10. Ed Carpenter as well, his first race. I don't think we covered this, but he got 7th at Phoenix. He did get a bit lucky, and Spencer Pigot did finish ahead of Montoya in 9th place after he had to miss the race at Phoenix. So this does set up Montoya pretty well for Indianapolis, who, as he has won there twice before, he's certainly no slouch anymore. Montoya is does seem to be in good form, and he certainly will be in contention at the end of May for the 500. This really does set up what is set to be a very unpredictable Indy 500, as basically I think the whole field has scored a top 10 finish at one stage. Yeah, the whole field, from basically 21st place, Spencer Pigot, all the way up, Mikhail Lotion, Marco Andretti, Graeme Rahal, J.R. Hildebrand,
The only person is Connor Daly. I think that's the only one.
Yeah, Connor Daly. Connor Daly is the only full-time IndyCar driver who has not scored a top 10 finish. How many series in the world can say that they have got all but one driver to score a top 10 finish in IndyCar? So it sets up to be a very, very unpredictable Indy 500. It's basically, there's got to be like around 10 serious contenders for this year's Indy 500, which is very fantastic for IndyCar.
Okay, moving on, of course, the qualifying for the Indianapolis 500 kicks off this weekend with pole day and bump day. Bump day is pretty much irrelevant now because they only got 33 entries because they don't have enough machinery to go around for a couple of extras. But we'll certainly have a very exciting battle for pole practice, of course, kicked off official practice for the Indianapolis 500. We saw Fernando Alonso Fernando Alonso in the top 20, which is a very strong result from him, 19th place. Marco Andretti, of course, topping that. The Hondas are always very, very strong. Ed Carpenter, top Chevrolet, in third place, actually, which is quite good. Followed by the Hondas of Sebastian Bourdais, Ryan Hunter-Reay, and Graeme Rahal. So, yeah, it certainly shows that Honda still seem to have it where it's at in terms of the super speedways. Their package just seems to be the strongest, and that is going to play very interestingly into Indianapolis 500 qualifying. My tip would have to be Scott Dixon, because he's just been flying under the radar, but he's had the consistent performances, and I think in proper machinery is by far the most experienced Honda driver up there, and I think he's in for a good result. So I'm going to pick him as my pole position pick, I think. Josh, who would you say would be up there?
For pole position, I would say Joseph Newgarden for pole position, and for the Indy 500 itself, Scott Dixon. Joseph Newgarden, like, you know, I am going to expect him to rise to the occasion and really put in a really good 500 qualifying. And Scott Dixon, you know, just target, Chip Ganassi right now, you know, they've certainly gone over the loss of Target. And they're just a really well-oiled machine. Like, you know, they have had really good strategy calls over the season so far. And the Indy 500 is both a strategy and a driver's game, and in both areas, Scott Dixon is in a really good place. So, yeah, but then again, yeah, we could be absolutely wrong. You know, we could have a situation where Scott Dixon is the first driver to crash out and retire from the Indy 500. We just don't know. So, yeah, it will be a very interesting Indy 500, as you know, everything is up for grabs. You know, nothing is for certain. You know, everything is far from certain. So, yeah, 33 drivers. You know, there's always a possibility of either one of them could being able to win it, no matter where you qualify. If you want any proof of that, just look at Alexander Rossi and his Indy 500 miracle win last year. So. Yeah, it's all to play for. It's going to be very, very unpredictable. Fernando Alonso in his first practice session with the rest of the IndyCar field, he did score a top 20 finish. So he's around the midfield, and realistically, I think, you know, people need to bring themselves back to reality. As you know, as much as we like to see, it's going to be pretty unlikely for Alonso to be really contending for the win, sitting in the top five with around 10 to 15 laps to go. As you know, it is his first oval race. As yeah, I do think that people just need to, you know, be a little bit realistic in terms of what to expect from Alonso over the next couple of weeks. So. Yeah, it's definitely going to be a very unpredictable 2 weeks, and you know, there's a possibility of anyone being able to win it, but yeah, you definitely have to keep an eye on the Honda runners, and also as well Team Penske.
Yeah, I think because of that, how wild it's going to be, I'm not going to say my 500 winner until after qualifying. It'll certainly be a great show when we preview everything next week. Now, moving on to the other big series in the United States, NASCAR. A wild, very wild race at Kansas. It was Martin Truex Jr. who yet again took the victory in overtime. Won his second race of the season. Is now really starting to form a proper championship tilt. Yeah, another decent race. Of course, there's been lots to talk about the format changes, but they seem to be working fairly well. I'm a purist, so I personally want something a little bit more spicy. But yeah, in general, another strong race from NASCAR and another strong race for Truex Jr., who is now really firming up as a real championship contender, and he might be able to do it this year, Josh.
Yeah, possibly. Like, you know, it is still early days, and for Truex Jr. to take that second win ahead of the All-Star race, you know, it's certainly yeah, good for him just to get that confidence. And yeah, it's going to be a big week ahead for NASCAR, heading into the Coca-Cola 600, and heading into basically you know, the whole festivities that is 2 weeks of Charlotte. So yeah, good confidence for him. Unfortunate how Eric Almirola was involved in a pretty serious crash late in the piece, as he did have to go to hospital, and he was diagnosed with a fracture in his T5 vertebra, which is, I'm certainly no doctor expert, but I'm assuming that's somewhere near in between the actual shoulder blade. So it's mid to upper back. The fracture is in his spinal cord. I think it's you know, it's still very early days. You know, he's certainly not going to be able to compete in the All-Star race. I'm not even sure if he was actually invited, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was. But unfortunately, we'll have to miss out on that. And you know, with the Coca-Cola 600 being such a long race, It wouldn't be surprising to if they just drafted in someone that will be actually be physically able and physically fit enough to complete the 600-mile marathon. So,
okay, we've just had some technical difficulties, but we just reset Josh's mic, so we should be all good to go. So, yeah, we were talking, of course, a little bit of NASCAR, and of course, yet again, leading the championship standings of the NASCAR Cup Series, Kyle Larson, just really putting another consistent performance in the top 10, doing everything he needs. I don't think he's actually finished outside of the top 20, which just shows just the year he's having. He's certainly really firming up as a surprise contender for the chase.
Yeah, and, certainly, people do rate Kyle Larson pretty highly, but no one expected for him to be a really serious championship contender so soon. But, as I said, as I've been saying, there is still a long way to go. And, I think the run after the 600, so the run into, June and July will certainly, start to firm up, the chase grid and who's on form and who's not, as, over the next month or so is, when the real championship contenders really do step up. So, Kyle Larson will definitely be in there. He's definitely got a really good chance of being in the championship four by the time the series gets to Homestead. But then again, there's a long way to go, and unfortunately, he could still be susceptible to some silly mistakes. So yeah, we'll just have to wait and see how it's going to play out. But yeah, Kyle Larson definitely is one to watch, as well as Chase Elliott, who is seemingly flying the flag for Hendrick Motorsport so far this year, which you certainly wouldn't have pictured just over 12 months ago when he was announced as Jeff Gordon's replacement.
Certainly going to be interesting and exciting for sure. So we head off to Charlotte for the first of the NASCAR All-Star Races, which is, the only NASCAR All-Star Race of the year, which is just generally just an insane weekend. We've, of course, got a different format. We go 20, 20, 20, 10, 70 laps. That's the way the stages work. And of course, only 10 cars will get a spot in the final 10 laps based on the way they perform in the field. You've got all of that. You've got the qualification system where you've got a separate race plus the fan vote. And of course, the qualifying, which is just ridiculous in that it's a three-time laps, including a four-tire pit stop where you just see the car just streaking through pit lane, trying to get in as fast as possible. No points on the line, but you have a $1 million prize money to play off. Certainly just another wild weekend, and just sort of the start of effectively the NASCAR home. It's the home event for pretty much everyone, because NASCAR is very much based out of Charlotte, and this is pretty much part one of the festivities, and of course part two being the Coca-Cola 600.
Yeah, and normally the All-Star race is pretty unpredictable in terms of who the eventual winner will be. You could just stay in the pack for 65 of those 70 laps, and then in the final few laps just come out of nowhere and take the win. So yeah, and also as well, as always, I think I said this time last year, the All-Star race is used as a bit of a extra testing for teams heading into the 600, as it does give them an edge over the non-participants in the All-Star race. There's really no such thing as too much information. So yeah, that's just not another thing to keep in mind. And unfortunately, with the hype of the Indy 500 and the Monaco Grand Prix this year, it's basically been relegated to a local speedway event in terms of where it sits on that glorious weekend. But then again, it isn't the same as last year where Kurt Busch led all but three laps of the 400 lap race. I think with the four stage system coming into play, because the race is so long with four stage system coming into play, at least it will be almost impossible for a 397 laps led out 400 being able to be repeated once again.
Yeah, it's going to be certainly another interesting NASCAR race for sure. Wrapping up wrapping up the weekend in terms of motorsport, we head to the Monaco E-Prix. Well, the first of effectively a rare thing in Formula E. You've got two races right on the back of each other, Monaco and then Paris. Sebastian Buemi yet again won. It's been a very strong season for him, the strongest yet, holding off Lucas Degrassi yet again. In another close, tight finish, it was a 0.32 margin at the end of the race. Degrassi just pushing right to the end, trying to just get ahead, but because Monaco is probably the most difficult track to pass on in the Formula E calendar, it just didn't happen, which was very a bit disappointing, but it was nice to see it. Another test finish. Buemi now has a 15-point lead. He needs at least 25 points because he will miss one round, I think, because of a clash with the World Endurance Championship. So that's going to be an interesting way to that particular championship plays out. Another solid Formula E race, probably not as much overtaking as we would have wanted, but it is Monaco. And to be honest, I think Monaco is an interesting fit for Formula E. I mean, it is a glamour race, but to be honest, I didn't really think it worked too well, particularly because we didn't get much overtaking, but also because the cars this year in particular did look really rather slow, particularly because they were using the same camera angles as Formula 1. You see the pace of F1 cars going. You see the Formula E cars, and it's just a little bit too much of a difference to sort of level it up. So, yeah, Josh, what do you think is the sort of the future of the Monaco round on Formula E? Because it is sort of the prestigious round, but it just sort of still feeling a little bit out of place in terms of the calendar, in terms of the way it sort of flatters Formula E in a way.
Yeah, well, I can certainly understand those concerns. And realistically, it was never really the intention to go back to Monaco after the first season. As it was always meant to be, just a one-hit wonder to just start the championship off, and with the way the calendar just shaped and formed, it reappeared, and realistically, it is good for the motorsport fans of Monaco because it just, it makes, the Monaco Grand Prix weekend more of an actual motorsport festival, with Formula E kicking it off and with it concluding with the Monaco Grand Prix. I don't really think, it's that wise to use, the same camera angles, as Formula One cars, as Naveen said. And, I just think that, Formula E just needs, I don't really like how Formula E, just sort of rests, on this circuit, just to put another event on the schedule, as I do think, that the tracks and calendars should be completely separate from Formula E and Formula One. I just don't think, it's the right decision to go and do the same races. As it's easy to criticize then, as Formula E just isn't ready to actually go to the same circuits as another series and make themselves hold their own. It's just not ready yet. So, I do share those concerns the overtaking is a little bit of an issue, as the beauty of the Formula E product over a street circuit on a race weekend is that the track, has so little grip, so that the drivers are always searching for grip, which creates various racing lines, not just one. Unfortunately, that does constrict it when they go to the Monaco E-Prix. It's not the best circuit for Formula E to go to. But then again, if they do, still have more scheduling holes and issues heading into next season, then it's acceptable then for them to return to the Monaco E-Prix. But then again, the Monaco E-Prix itself, it's become more of just a backup race for failed race bids.
Yeah, that certainly seems to be the way it's turning out. So, a big weekend of motorsport. We, of course, have the NASCAR All-Star Race, Formula E in Paris, the Winston Super Sprint, Indianapolis 500 qualifying, and, of course, MotoGP France, which we'll have a look at next week when we wrap it all up. Still plenty of action to talk about, and there'll be plenty of action next week, which will be our big preview show of the Monaco Grand Prix and the Indy 500, and we'll, of course, be wrapping up all the action from across the weekend. But until then, I've been Naveen Razik.
And I've been Josh Carroll.
And we'll see you next time. Goodbye.